Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today I'll be talking to poets who are also singers. Later in the hour, songwriter, poet, and musician Jeremy Gerard will tell us about a new album by his band, The Rugs. We'll hear the title song from that album, Arrow and Bow. Then Chico Enterprise Record book reviewer Dan Barnett will read a favorite poem by Chico State philosophy professor Troy Jollimore, who won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his first book of poetry. Poet Paula Amanjuda was born in Nebraska and grew up in Napa, California, where she taught in the county jail and performed in bands at night. For the past 23 years, she has lived in Castella, California, a tiny town in Shasta County. She worked at Dunsmuir High School, where she founded Youth Enhancement Services, directed plays, taught poetry, sex education, drama, and Spanish. She is a volunteer grief counselor, a serious gardener, and has just published a collection of her poems, Añoranza, Spanish for yearning, longing. In these poems, she recalls events in her childhood, narratives of joy and distress, impressions of a small-town girl whose family is dominated by a father's harsh rule over the household. Paula Amanjuda, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, I did say that your collection of poems has to do with your childhood, but I want to start with where you are now, because you have a poem about where you live now.
Yes.
And there is a word you end where the third verse ends with a line in Spanish. And you use a word that I especially like. It has a cognate in English, but I don't think many people use it. So you don't know which word I'm talking about, perhaps, or maybe you suspect.
I suspect.
Okay. Would you read in your book, and this happens to be the very last poem in your book.
Yes.
Castella. Would you read that, please?
Yes. Visitation 2, Castella. The mountain wind is back, a faint perception in the distance summoning from the south. I set aside the shovel, remove my work gloves, and wait. I recognize this wind. I feel it first not on my skin, but in my blood, bones, tissues. I hear its nearing whisper, ese susurro familiar.
And this is Paula Amanjuda, and her collection of poems is Añoranza.
Yes.
And she lives now in Castella, California. And so you wrote this poem about where you live now. And that last line you just read, would you read that again?
Ese susurro familiar.
And that second word is a favorite word of mine in English and in Spanish.
Yes.
Explain what that word means.
Well, it means a whispering, but it sounds, it's so onomatopoetic.
Exactly.
It sounds like what it is. And that's why I chose Añoranza, too, because it sounds to me like longing and yearning more than it does in English. You know, Añoranza, susurro. I fell in love with the language, you can tell that.
Yeah, so tell people again what susurro means in Spanish.
Well, it means a whispering, susurro, a whisper, the nearing whisper, ese susurro familiar. And I'm saying that familiar whispering coming up from below. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
And again, the word cognate exists in English, which is such a nice word.
It's
and
beautiful.
I do love words that sound like they're meaning.
I know you do. I listen to your show. And plus, you speak Spanish, it sounds like.
Well, I did live a year in Peru, but you also lived a year in South America.
In Colombia.
And what took you to Colombia? You just decided, okay, I'm going to learn Spanish. I'm going to go live in Colombia for a year.
I wish it were that intellectual. It was a man.
Oh, yes.
Well, first it was a love affair with the language, and I had loved it in high school. And then I had a brother-in-law who was Mexican, and I got to practice a little. And then I took it at the college, and the tutor from Colombia, and I went there with him for the better part of a year. And my teacher said, all you need to do is live in a country, and you've got it down. And I did. And well, I have many, I'm sorry to interrupt. I have a lot of Mexican family, so I speak.
Well, I think it's appropriate because you spent time as a singer. I don't know if you still sing, perform, do you?
I don't perform anymore. My sister still does the band I used to be in, but I don't perform anymore. I garden. Right.
Well, I think it's appropriate that a singer would also be a poet because you hear sounds as music. Mm-hmm. And poetry is music to me.
To me, too.
So I think it's appropriate that you as a singer would bring those talents to your career as a poet.
Yeah, and the rhythm, too. That I played hand percussion as well as guitar, and the rhythm, I love the rhythm of poetry in the words. You've probably noticed that.
I do. Now, I also mentioned that you taught in the county jail when you were in Napa, and I was wondering if your dad's occupation influenced you to be to want to do that, to go into a jail and teach, because I think most of us would be hesitant to do something like that.
That's a probing question. I looking back on it, I thought how ironic the cop's daughter is now teaching inmates, and I didn't go into it thinking, oh, I know this territory, although I did, because if you read poems like Dinner Table, I was surrounded by cops and guns and everything growing up, so it wasn't alien to me, but the incarcerated setting was new for me, but I don't know, I just felt fine doing it. And I learned as much as, I mean, they taught me as much as I taught them, and it was a wonderful experience, to tell you the truth. We had a wonderful staff there that cooperated and felt like we did a little good.
Well, you don't tell us right in the very beginning with your in the way you have your poems arranged what your parents' wedding day was like, but later on you have a poem that you call, you don't say it because it's happening to him, you're saying what came before. And it's rather sad and touching what you write in this poem. This is on page 53.
Thank you.
Book. And you tell us what came before in this poem.
This is the epigraph that I'm going to read between the title and the poem, the epigraph. What came before? I never learned the details of their wedding day, only the dark velvet dress she wore and later cut up to make a pirate costume for me. One. I wonder what shoes she wore walking with him up the courthouse steps in Council Bluffs, Iowa, to stand before the justice, say I do, and accept the thinnest possible gold band from the pawn shop, its frailty a sign of the corrosive disappointment to come. Years later, she declared, your father just wasn't cut out for married life.
And that's so sad.
Isn't it?
And when I'm reading your poems, I'm assuming this is every bit the truth, because it comes across as absolute truth.
It is every bit the truth.
And to have your mother say your father just wasn't cut out for married life, that's heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking, and that she survived to find a better husband later is the victory part, I suppose, you know.
And you say apparently they got married in Council Bluffs, Iowa. You were born in Nebraska.
Yeah, they went across the border. It's just a couple of miles, a few miles from where she was. I should say that many of these poems I would never have published if my mom were still alive, because they're too painful.
Yes. Yes, I can understand that. Mm-hmm. Well, you have this poem is divided into parts, so that was the first part, and then we skip ahead, perhaps, because this young woman only 19 in this section, so read that part.
Two. A cold Nebraska day, a young woman, 19, heaving heavy-bellied up the long flight of concrete stairs, dropped off by a distant relation, left to climb alone and give birth with no companion nearby. She names the baby not after him as he believes, but for her beloved chum from grammar school. He never knew. I relished that secret my whole life.
So apparently your mother told you that little bit of information.
She did, and it was me that she was giving birth to. Yes, so my name is Paula. My father is Paul.
And so he thought, oh, how nice. My daughter's named Paula because my name is Paul. And it was really a different Paul.
That's right. She relished it.
Okay. And then 14 months later.
Yes. Three. 14 months later, he hopes for a boy. This night, she enters the hospital with confidence, her husband by her side. Hours pass. No doctor comes. Voices implore, don't push, don't push. After midnight, the doctor arrives drunk and belligerent. Nurses cajole him into giving my mother something for pain. A half century later, she still remembers the smell of his breath, the slur of his words. It was a terrible birth. Can you tell that's my mother talking at the end of each stanza?
Yes. Okay. In fact, listeners could see what you've written, that last line is in italics. So that distinguishes, it shows us visually that this is your mother talking, saying that it was a terrible birth.
It worries me when people hear it that they won't get that. And I thought, should I say she said, but I kind of like the flow the way it is.
Yes, and we can tell people that. Well, okay, and then part four?
Oh, all right, four. Four children now, she picks up the ringing kitchen phone. Two deputies' wives, each on an extension, are calling about her husband's speech at the Peace Officer Association meeting the night before. All the men wanted to invite the wives to the Christmas party this year. Your husband was the only one who was against it. What did you do? I asked her. I just told them I was sorry.
This is Paula Amanjuda reading from her collection of poems, Añoranza. And this poem in particular is What Came Before. And so it's kind of a flashback, recapping the years when your parents first got married and then how insensitive your dad was.
Yes, he was.
But, you know, as I was reading this about your dad, I hear so many similar stories of my generation that I'm thinking, do I really blame my dad and you blame your dad for maybe being a product of that period of time when that's the way husbands treated their wives?
Well, you know, certainly there's a truth about mid-century, you know, the 50s and all, but he had a lot of friends who didn't treat their wives that way, and I had uncles who treated their wives with more respect. But, yeah, I mean, it was a different time, and I, you know, you use the word blame, and I'm pretty much recounting. I
hesitate to use that word.
But, no,
blame.
It's okay, because I did for years, but I've lost the blame, and I think writing this helped me exorcise that mentality of, you know.
Yes, yes, because it's not productive.
It's not productive.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And I think, too, that today's generation of husbands are so much more sensitive. The wives are stronger and assert themselves more. And a young woman now, I don't think, would tolerate what you and my mother tolerated generation.
Nor probably would you or I.
Oh, I agree.
Maybe when I was... I wouldn't.
Speaking of our generation, because you look much younger than you must be, because I read your very first poem, and I thought, my goodness, this is little Paula. And the title of your very first poem in the collection is Performance 1944. Mm-hmm. So in 1944, you were already old enough to talk.
Oh, yes. I was talking very early. But, yeah, I was born in 42.
Well, read us that little poem there, Performance 1944.
For all the World War II buffs?
Yes.
Okay. Performance 1944. Thinned by combat and gunshot, he lifts me up in my pink dress with tiny sleeves, laced high tops, polished white, and places me on the highest step of the concrete porch, stands below and begins the drill. I am ready. Who's the president of the United States of America? Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Who's the supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe? General Dwight David Eisenhower. Who's the commander of the Third Army? General George Smith Patton. He tosses me question after question. I answer each one perfectly. His audience applauds. Victory is ours.
Well, I might mention that visually we can see the difference in the who's the president of the United States is in regular type and then in italics because it's a different voice, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So you might say, who's the president of the United States?
That's Dad.
And Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Tiny little Paula.
Yeah. And he would bring his friends around and have me do this. You know, my mother told me. I don't remember this. My mother told me over and over that I did it. your dad was so proud.
And so when you were born, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. And, of course, it was during wartime. And David Eisenhower was a hero. And George Patton was a hero. Now, just a couple of pages after that poem, you have a poem that's... Mm-hmm. It's... another touching poem, and your mother is getting ready for the policeman's ball. That's the title of this poem, Getting Ready for the Policeman's Ball. Read that one for us, Paula.
Okay. May I preface it?
Oh, sure.
In Napa, a big event every year back in the day was the annual policeman's ball. Everybody went. It was held at the fairgrounds. And
I might remind people that's where you grew up.
I grew up
in
Napa.
You were born in Lincoln, Nebraska, but you grew up in Napa.
As an infant brought to, yeah. And everybody went. But my sister and I, the two that were born when I remember this, we hated it because they'd always come home fighting over something. And the story goes that my mother was dancing with another cop, and my dad looked up, didn't like that, and went out and decked the guy. So, but this is about getting ready for the policeman's ball. Okay. My mother in her good slip sits silent before the mirror. Her friend Nan clucks and fusses, works the makeup to reveal cheeks and lashes I have never seen. She gathers my mother's ample brown hair back and up and transforms it with fingers, ice blue gel, and a rat tail comb into a mass of magazine perfect curls. I sit open mouthed, thrilled, disoriented, smitten with the creature emerging from this person who drives us to school in her robe and slippers. Nan pats her work with rounded palms, puts both hands on my mother's shoulder, her cheek next to hers, the two of them looking into the mirror, and she proclaims, "There, done." As my mother exhales and ventures a smile, my father comes through the front door, tosses his keys on the coffee table, throws a glance her way, and heads for the bathroom, says, "I don't like it." Without speaking, my mother begins to dismantle the work, tears frozen in her eyes.
This is Paula Amenjuda reading from her collection of poems, Añoranza, which is a Spanish word for a yearning, longing. You tell these stories about your dad and your mother, but you're going back even farther than that. I mentioned that you were born in Lincoln, Nebraska. You grew up in Napa. But I don't know if you know, there is an author here in Chico who also grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. He's written a lot of books. He's also a photographer. And he happens to have a collection of photographs taken in Lincoln. He didn't take them. He was just in high school at the time. Taken in Lincoln, Nebraska of immigrant communities, neighborhoods. And so when I saw that your paternal grandfather, Jacob Rudolph Ammon, immigrated from Russia in 1888 and settled in Lincoln, Nebraska, and already had an uncle there from the family established there, and I was thinking, now, wouldn't that be interesting if in Douglas Keister is the one who has this collection of photographs from these neighborhoods in Lincoln, Nebraska, would it be interesting if one of your ancestors was in his photographs.
It would be, I heard that interview and I loved it. It was fascinating to me. Yeah, I know my mom said that they lived down on the bottoms. The Russians were kind of like the N-words of Nebraska at that time and poor. But Uncle Jake, same name, he got rich from land and stuff. So I would like to know. I would love to see. I think I would recognize him if I thought maybe I should call.
Yeah, contact Douglas Keister and say, "Doug, you might have a photograph of one of my ancestors in the Russian immigrant community in Lincoln, Nebraska."
I will contact him. Thank you.
Well, there's another relative of your maternal grandmother. Mm-hmm. You say she was born in Texas but moved to Chico, and that's where she grew up. But you know what? You say you can't verify this, but according to family lore, your great-great-grandfather?
I think so.
Was an itinerant Methodist minister who worked for John Bidwell, mm-hmm. and planted trees at one of the entrances to Chico State University.
Right. Yeah, my mother told me he planted trees to the entrance of the college, the university. And then years later, I got to see it. Which entrance? I guess it was small back then. Yeah, and I haven't been able to find anything on that.
To confirm that.
No, I believe it. Mm-hmm. But I can't confirm it.
Wouldn't that be interesting if you were able to prove that your great-great-grandfather helped plant trees at the entrance to Chico State University?
Yeah, it would be fantastic.
Working for John Bidwell.
Annie's my hero.
Annie
her.
Bidwell.
Yep.
Yes. The only photograph in your book is a very interesting photograph. It's one of you as a little girl You're sitting on, I'm assuming it's your dad's motorcycle.
It's the Sergeant Jack Johnson of the Napa PD's Harley.
And I know it's Napa because over your shoulder, there's a sign that says Money's Dry Cleaners. Mm-hmm. And we know that by the time we get to that page, it's in the back of your book. By the time we get to that page and see the photograph, we have read your poem about Brown Street.
Yes.
So would you read that poem for us now?
I would. Let's find Brown Street.
It's on page 65.
Thank you. This is always for my mother. Brown Street. I want to walk with my mother on Brown Street again. Catch the breath of clothy steam from Money's Cleaners. Hear the bell jingling against the thick glass door as patrons come and go. See Mr. Money counting out change into the cupped hands of children sent in to pick up their father's slacks. I want to shade my eyes against the dark blue glint of the tiles that lined the front of the Napa PD, where I posed limp-shouldered and alone in my Easter bonnet, chin and mouth turned down under the shadow of my sister's stiff refusal to enter the picture. I want to walk with my mother on Brown Street again, visit the wide lobby of the Plaza Hotel, overstuffed chairs with their rough upholstery sitting just inside the door, the smell of bourbon trailing over from the Velly's bar, where, through a red straw, I tasted my first Shirley Temple in the hazy light, waiting with Dad and the rest of the cops for the bus to the 49ers game. I want to run with my mother across Brown Street in the early morning, skip up the stairs of the old courthouse, past suited lawyers and punctual clerks and men in overalls. Want to hear again the echo of footsteps on marble floors, the sound of the bailiff's steady, "All rise," the strike of the gavel's authority on dark wood. I want to inhale the air of that reliable building and pause to read the gold print on the windowed doors. Assessor, Superior Court. I want to walk with my mother on Brown Street again.
This is poet Paula Amenjuda reading from her collection of poems, Añoranza, which is Spanish for yearning, longing. And I'm sure there are so many, not just daughters, but children who would love to have a chance to do something with their parent again. Like yes. You have this longing. Oh, just to walk down Brown Street again with my mother.
Yeah, and Brown Street the way it was, because Napa is no longer a small town and everything is pretty much devoted to the wine industry, whereas mm-hmm. I grew up with orchards and space and small town.
It was a different Napa that you grew up in.
Yeah, this Napa in this book.
Well, one thing that I don't think is different, and you mentioned in this poem the 49ers, and there's a poem, so we know that your dad was a 49ers fan. Would you read that poem? It's called Sharpshooter. That's on page 34 in your book.
Okay, yes, I will. We're family or lifelong 49er fans. No choice. Okay, Sharpshooter. On football Sundays, escape was easier. The 49ers moved gracefully across the screen, covering me while I executed patterns of my own. You had to be smart, agile, and very quiet. The trick was to walk through the room and not fall within my father's line of sight, to map out ahead of time how to get from where you were to the kitchen for water or the bedroom for homework, and not let him notice you from his stretched-out vantage point on the couch. You had to move more swiftly once the decision was made, but too much haste would alert his deadly peripheral vision or trigger that uncanny sense of where you were in the house. For the times I knew I could not escape his glance, I perfected a way of walking with shoulders a degree forward, head down, and turned slightly away from him so he could not see the new blemishes on my skin and order me to the bathroom to scrub my face again.
And that is hurtful.
It's humiliating.
Say. And we know by that last line, those last two lines, that you must have been a teenager at that time?
Yeah, about 12.
At 12.
Yeah.
Yeah, that your dad would, not only walks through the room and tells your mother, "I don't like that," mm-hmm. her hairdo and the way she's trying to look nice, and he says, "I don't like that." And in that one sentence, he can crush your mother, and then I'm sure it only in a few words that he hurts your feelings.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
terribly.
You're sensitive enough at that age about your looks. And then here's your dad saying, "Go wash your face again."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're wrong. there's something wrong with you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He told me never to let anyone take a photo of me on profile because my nose was unfortunately inherited from my mother's side of the family.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's amazing we all come out of it, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He seemed to be one of those guys who had no clue about women's feelings.
Women? Feelings? What? I should say he taught me to throw a ball.
Yes, you say he was a baseball player.
Good baseball player. He was a hockey, ice hockey in Nebraska. And he was an athletic guy, and he did teach us, all of us, to play sports, and I'm grateful for that.
What else did your dad teach you?
Shoot a gun. It's funny, the name of that is sharpshooter, and he was a dead eye, literally.
Because I wondered about the title of this book, because it talks about his watching football on Sundays, the 49ers, and you're trying to not disturb him. And then so I wonder, well, where did sharpshooter come from?
Well, his eyes, he's like a sharpshooter when he caught me. I mean, that's why I had to hide. But he's also literally was a sharpshooter and, you know, the firearms instructor and everything. And he had me on my belly shooting a gun when I was just a kid. Yeah.
But yet you say now, as an adult, these many years later, you can look back and not feel, it sounds like you're more accepting of your dad now, perhaps?
I'm more at peace with it.
More at peace with it.
Yeah, and you can accept something without approving of it,
yes.
You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, he had a rough life, too, growing up in an immigrant, quasi-immigrant household, and... So it's, you know, I don't know if forgiveness is the right word, but I get it. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine. Here I am. I'm fine. I survived it.
And you have a poem in your book that's dedicated to your stepdad. Mm-hmm. So your mother went on to have a maybe a more pleasant life?
A wonderful life. The life she deserved. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to my stepdad.
Yeah, you write a very touching poem to him. In fact, I thought it was interesting because some of your poems, you mention who you dedicate the poem to.
Yes.
But you say it in English. And then for Flying Kite, you say, dedicado a George Simmons, your stepdad. And I was wondering why you wrote that in Spanish. Is it because the next line says, mi padre de corazón?
You know, mi padre de corazón was just, it was all of a piece. I tell you, and I said that to other people, asked me, I don't know why, but I knew I had to have this in Spanish. And maybe it's because his first language was Portuguese. And, you know, another language. I don't know why. It's something, poetic license, maybe.
Well, I've enjoyed so much your poems, and thank you for writing this collection. This is Paula Amenjuda. Her collection of poems is Añoranza, which is Spanish for yearning and longing. Thank you so much, Paula.
Thank you.
After a short break, songwriter, poet, and musician Jeremy Girard will tell us about a new album by the local band, The Rugs. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you.
you now. You gotta earn what you deserve. Hit the split, hit the chain. Boy, you gotta hit the curve. Imagine a mind, isn't there a way more? Gotta aim true, see it through and let it go.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. The Swedish Academy surprised a lot of people by naming a songwriter as the 2016 recipient of the Nobel Prize in Literature. And the voice of my next guest, Chico songwriter Jeremy Gerard, even sounds like Bob Dylan. Jeremy teaches writing, reading, and literature, and also taught English as a second language at Chico State University and at Butte College. He has published literary analysis, essays, short stories, and poems. He's been playing and writing music for 20 years, and during that time, he has been in 9 different bands. His current band, The Rugs, has released their second all-original album, Arrow and Bow. In fact, the music that was playing when we came back from the break was the title song from that album, Arrow and Bow. Jeremy Gerard is the lead guitarist and vocalist for The Rugs. In the interest of full disclosure, Nolan Ford, who engineers this show, is a contributing musician in The Rugs and friend of Jeremy Gerard. Jeremy Gerard, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you majored in English as when you were at Chico State.
I did.
And I'm assuming that maybe you were already writing poems then?
I was. Probably not as well as I did after those classes, but... words were always something that I was into from a young age, but the more I paid attention to them. And certainly in those classes, the more I got really into how they can be used in lots of different ways.
Well, one of my favorite songwriters was an English major, Paul Simon.
Oh, yeah. I love Paul Simon. I love Paul Simon a lot. He and you mentioned Dylan at the beginning. He and Dylan both are people that I continually go back to.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Well, when you were originally writing, did you ever imagine that you were going to be writing music for a band?
No, I didn't. I actually just started playing music by just copying a bunch of other people. And then it wasn't until my brothers kind of gave me a hard time for knowing too many of other people's songs that I should start to write my own. And when I did, it was all just for myself, solo things. I did that for years before I wrote for a band.
So you write the music, the words, or both?
Both. Not always in a particular order. I don't think it's good to have a set order of doing things when it comes to art.
So sometimes the words, say, like a poem, mm-hmm. come to you first and you think, oh, I'd like to put those words to music.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's a word in itself. Sometimes it's a phrase. Sometimes it's a whole thought. And sometimes it's some scattered bits and pieces that find their ways together.
Well, let's take that song that we were listening to, mm-hmm. Arrow and Bow. How did you approach that? I assume that you wrote the skeleton originally. Other band members may have contributed their ideas.
Sure.
But where did you start when you wrote that?
That one, I think, actually started with the line that ends up getting repeated at the end. And while we're giving shout-outs, I think that was Katrina's idea while we're talking about
Rodriguez.
A joint effort. Yes, Katrina Rodriguez. But it started with that that line, you've got to earn what you deserve. And then it sort of built from there.
So you mentioned Katrina mm-hmm. Rodriguez, who is the other vocalist. Mm-hmm. Well, not the other.
Right.
But one of the other main vocalists.
That's
in
right.
your band, The Rugs.
Mm-hmm.
So how many pieces are in your band?
We have five. We have myself and Katrina on guitars, and then Nolan on the bass guitar, and then we've got Austin King on drums, and our newest member, Andy, on the keyboards.
So Nolan Ford is the one you referred to. And was Nolan the one that you originally went to with the idea, hey, Nolan, let's create a band?
I think he actually came to me. He was a fan of the band I was in previously. And I think I always wanted to start something after that, and the timing was right, and he knew some extra people, and I knew some extra people, and here we are several years later.
My guest is Jeremy Gerard, and he actually teaches English. He was an English major at Chico State, and he uses his love for words to write lyrics to songs and music to go along with those lyrics. And then people will probably wonder, well, how do they always want to pigeonhole music?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's not easy to do. But I'm going to ask you mm-hmm. how you describe your sound to somebody who's never heard it before.
Sure. I usually describe it as a throwback rock effort that has, and by throwback, I mean some extra attention to harmonies and melodies and some bluesy guitar solos and that kind of thing that was. I think more popular years ago, but we have our own contemporary flair as well.
So when you're writing the music, you take inspiration for some of your favorite music from the past?
I do, yeah. Bob Dylan and Paul Simon, you mentioned lyrically, but there's also a lot of great lyricists even around town and people that I grew up with who I think are good lyricists. And then in music-wise, I'll pull from older ones like the Beatles and such, and the newer ones, Dr. Dog and the Shins. And so it's a big amalgam of quite a spread of influences.
Now, Nolan Ford is the man who engineers Nancy's Bookshelf. So he's a musician, and he came to you because he liked your music that you played in another band. So
that's
you
right.
And he have similar taste in music, would you say?
Yeah, we do. It's not something that overlaps all of the time. There are things that that I like that I'm sure he doesn't, and vice versa. But we do share a lot of the same influences and appeal.
So not only do you write songs yourself, but you've taught other people how to write songs.
I have. I've tried anyway. That's not to say that that the efforts are lost on others. It's just it is a harder thing to do than I had thought. Harder than teaching English, it turns out.
Uh-huh. So Butte College sponsors a writing conference.
That's right.
And you had the idea, I'll have a workshop on songwriting at this conference.
Well, it was their idea. Molly Emmons is the one who kind of spearheads that. And she came to me and asked if I would do it because I had actually gone into her creative writing class once. She invited me in to play some songs and talk about the lyrics. And then after that, she invited me to come to the conference, which I've done a couple times now.
And you say it's not easy to teach people how to write songs.
It's not. No, it's something that is has to be very unique and individual. But it also, of course, is for the world. It's something that is that then exists in the world, and so it has to respond to that and influence that world. And so everyone has different worlds that they that they're a part of, and so it's difficult to. To put yourself in others' shoes when you're trying to create something. Part of creating is that you're in your shoes.
My guest is Jeremy Gerard, and he is the lead guitarist and vocalist for a local band, The Rugs, but he also writes the music for this group. And you came out with this new album, mm-hmm. is your second album, mm-hmm. and the cover of the album is not what I would expect on the cover of an album from what you describe as your music.
Sure.
It looks rather sci-fi, like science fiction.
It does, doesn't it? And I shared your sentiment, actually. my first reaction it was very cool looking, but I wasn't sure what the thematic or aesthetic connection was to either the music or the lyrics. And
So who came up with this cover idea and said, here, Jeremy, take a look at this. And you said, what?
This was, his name is Hunter Hackett. He lives in San Diego. And I think he does work with a partner of his. I'm not sure if it's a girlfriend or something, but they work together and they created it. And then it came out the way it came out. And like I said, I thought it was cool looking, but I'm still searching for
how it
for
relates
ways to
your
connect
music.
The dots. Yeah.
So describe this cover for us.
Well, it takes place in outer space, it seems, and there is a big green octopus-looking space monster that
so
is.
So right away we've got our brain twisted by the fact. Well, is this outer space or is this undersea and
yes,
underwater?
Right. It looks.
That's where octopi live.
Yeah, it looks very much like both, and the colors are really cool. Actually, there's a greens and maroons and such, but a space woman is. Shooting some sort of laser gun at it and doing a pretty good job from what we can tell. And that's that's all that I know, really. Others might have more to weigh in that I'll investigate.
And the title of one of the songs is He, She, and the Sea.
Indeed.
So I could see that might relate to an octopus.
It could. The intent there is really... I mentioned putting yourself in other people's shoes, and that one really is doing it back and forth from a two different people in a relationship's perspectives of very similar things in relation to the sea around them, which is a common metaphor for that.
My guest is songwriter Jeremy Gerard. He's a musician and English teacher. And he writes the music for his band, The Rugs. And you also have taught English as a second language.
I have, yeah, for years now. I kind of just fell into that, and it's been great. I sometimes will have 12 or 13 different countries represented at once. So it's, needless to say, a challenge, but a very fun and rewarding one.
In fact, I would imagine, because I've taught foreign languages too, that songs are an easy way to learn a foreign language. I still remember how to sing Lely Marleen in German, even though my German is pretty rusty, but I can remember how to sing songs. So do you use your songwriting skills in your English as a foreign second language classes?
I wouldn't say I use my own songwriting skills, but I certainly do use songs. I use them for a variety of reasons. And I remember when I was learning languages, I always loved songs. I loved when teachers brought them in. Of course, I'm probably a little biased in that sense, but I do use songs often in my ESL classes, and they love it. They really do.
I would think they do. So when you are performing, how do you decide who would sing if you have another vocalist? For example, you mentioned Katrina.
Yeah.
And would you say you're the main vocalist? I would imagine Nolan also, I don't know if he sings solo, but he also is a vocalist, no?
He sings quite a bit as well. He and Katrina sing backup in one way or another on nearly every track. And that's something that that they work out more than I do. I kind of have some spaces in mind where things could go, but the layers and certainly the figuring out the harmonies is all them.
What's an example of a song that they sing back up for you?
Let's see. On the title track that you heard earlier, there's
Arrow and Bow.
Arrow and Bow. There are several voices on the choruses that are pretty vibrant, I'd say. But I think on each track there really is something. I'm trying to think of one that doesn't really. Some more than others, sure. But in one way or another, they appear, and it's a level and a texture that we couldn't do without.
Well, do they sometimes compose the lyrics themselves that they sing, or do you say, here's what I think you guys should sing?
The lyrics that that they end up singing are usually ones that I've written that they'll maybe borrow from an earlier part of the song or repeat or something like that. But they do a lot of like oohs and ahs and that kind of melodic stuff.
Like you would expect from backup singers.
Exactly. But they do such a great job of it that it's as key as the words, really.
Now, you recently went on tour, did you not, up the coast of California, up the West Coast?
We did, yeah, somewhat recently. We made our way up to Seattle and back. And
it's not your first tour, was it?
No. I had done that with the Rugs a couple times before, and I had toured with that previous band I mentioned, the Amblers. And every time it's such a joy to access all those other worlds and just give them something that we've created.
My guest is Jeremy Gerard. He is a singer-songwriter, English teacher. What else are the hats you wear?
Those are certainly the main ones, but I think all of the other ones are more of hobbies than anything else.
Well, I'd like to hear some more of your music, and so maybe we can let Nolan play us out with some more indie music.
I trust his judgment.
Yes.
July burns your eyes. memory lane is sinking, tricked you into thinking the future is a ruse. Lasting departures wait or choke ya. You know that you're supposed to say see ya blue. Oh.
Chico Enterprise Record book reviewer Dan Barnett has selected a poem from Syllabus of Errors, the latest collection of poems by award-winning poet Troy Jollimore.
Troy Jollimore teaches philosophy at Chico State University, but he is also a nationally recognized poet and an award-winning one. Recently, his new book, Syllabus of Errors, well, when I read it, I was struck by many of the poems, but two in particular. One is called On Beauty, and I like how he brings in some philosophical terms, and the cadence is a lot of fun. So here is On Beauty. Beauty, some have ventured, is proportional, the right relative ratio of the actual against the actual. Others hypothesize that beauty's roots lie buried in the sexual, insisting that aesthetics are relational. The eye of the beholder is the noumenal perceiving core, where spores of the phenomenal sprout into lit screen images. The visual is permeated down to the foundational with lust, with longing. Say it! We are animals! Which does not mean that we must all be criminals, but only that desire is constitutional, that we are fixed to perpetuate the species, I mean perpetuate, as if our duty were coupled with our terror, as if beauty itself were but a syllabus of errors. Now, when I read that, and sometimes it's difficult for me to pull out all of the various meanings, and perhaps that's the joy of poetry, that you can return to it endlessly and find more. But when I teach a class, I pass out the syllabus that says, all right, here's what's going to go on in class, and here's how you are going to be graded. And at the very beginning of On Beauty, when the poet says beauty is proportional. There is this right relative ratio of the actual against the actual. And then the poet goes on to say, or maybe there's something else going on, that beauty might have to do with what is constitutional with us, with our desire, our lust, our imperfections, because we are animal. And we don't have to be criminal, the poet says, but somehow that is part, that animal part is what we are as humans. And so beauty seems to emerge not from this perfect ratio, but from something that is imperfect. I'm very moved by that and what it might mean. A second poem is called Cutting Room. And there's an epigraph from The Man Who Wasn't There by Ethan Cohen of 2001. Sooner or later, everyone needs a haircut. The note of longing that creeps into the voice of the woman who cuts my hair when she says, oh, it was amazing. She's speaking of the time she was 21 and went for a week-long cruise around the Virgin Islands on a friend's sailboat. It's so heartfelt, so hushed, so purely human that it makes me wonder what parts of the story she is leaving out, what she isn't saying, which suspends itself, as the unsaid always does, like a shadow or aura over the words she has allowed herself to say. Meanwhile, her scissors sing the snip, snip, snip of revision, and small seed packets of my hair are drifting to the floor as if through humid forest air. As always, I have let it grow too long, and have come in looking like a middle-aged professor of philosophy who is trying to look a little like Roger Daltrey, or, if he's lucky, Robert Plant. A gesture, perhaps, toward the life I get to live in the alternative plotline, the deleted scenes hidden in my life's special edition DVD. The poem does go on, but I thought it was very interesting to take this idea, simple idea of cutting hair and of cutting and fixing our own stories to make a special edition, and the great privilege we have of reading poetry, of having poetry affect us, and somehow, mysteriously, having the poet's words touch us in the real world.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Barnett writes the bibliophile column for the Chico Enterprise Record and teaches philosophy at Butte College. He read a poem from Syllabus of Errors by Chico State philosophy professor Troy Jollimore, winner of a National Book Critics Circle Award. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.